There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap, and I'm Malcolm Taylor. In this hour, we're going to hear about Masdar's $86 million investment into UK electric vehicle charging stations. Plus, amortization rates are on the rise. But first, let's hear from Vijay Valecha, Chief Markets Officer at Century Financial, to look at the Saudi Aramco IPO and what effect the massive size of it will have on all of the other shares on the Saudi stock market.
IPO by itself, of course, is not that big. It's $12 to $14 billion, but the company, of course, is probably the biggest company in the world. It has profits twice as much as Apple does, so it really does make an impact.
So when do you think part one will happen?
So part one most likely is first quarter next year, and JP Morgan is said to be running it.
Because we've been hearing rumors that it might happen as early as November. Are you saying that is probably unlikely now?
It's unlikely.
Look, I mean, given that the Saudi hierarchy are clinging to a valuation for the company closer to the original $2 trillion mark, the industry saying sort of closer 1.3 to 1.5 trillion, what percentage probability do you see in it actually happening at all in the next 6 months?
Most likely it should happen in the next 6 months. And of course, 1.5 trillion is what the numbers are coming through. Most likely the company should be listing around 1% at $12 to $14 billion.
But I mean, the big question is what will happen to all of the other companies listed on the Tadawul market? 1% of Aramco would constitute about 5% of the market on day one. And the market's been falling since April this year as people free up money to try and invest into the Aramco equity when it becomes available. And that's wiped out most of this year's gains.
So it actually does wipe out the gain that actually has had the best in the market so far. So if you look at the Tadawul index, it's actually been the best performing index in the Middle East space. It's definitely going to eat up a lot of liquidity, but at the same time, I think it's the best way to go forward.
When you say it's been the most best performing, I mean the fall since April has wiped out most of the gains for this year.
It's just a little less negative than the other indices.
Aramco profit in the first half of the year was more than four times the combined earnings of the 170 Saudi publicly traded companies that have been reporting earnings. What does it mean for foreign inflows, do you think? Estimates suggest that $1.9 billion in inflows from MSCI and FTSE investors will happen. Do you think anyone's going to look at the smaller, more illiquid local Saudi stocks?
So ideally what happens is when you have a really big company coming and really floating it, what happens is that it actually gains interest in the entire stock market. So initially, yes, there'll be a dip, but overall I think that it actually gains interest for all these small companies as well.
What do you think that means then for the banks such as Al Rajhi, who currently make up about 15% of the Tadawul index? Obviously their impact on the market will be reduced.
So the market share, of course, will reduce, but Al Rajhi Bank is overall a very great bank. Their numbers are really good, so they shouldn't be really impacted.
Vijay, thanks very much for your time. Vijay Valecha, the Chief Market Analyst at Century Financial. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Malcolm Taylor. A new report out suggests that amortization employment rates are on the rise. This is Thansh Kuganathan, founder of Visible HR, to explain the industry's approach.
I definitely agree with the article from Hayes. I think it's definitely picking up, but I think it's only natural. In 2017, the UAE announced that they were going to start monitoring the private sector and their amortization quotas. So, you know, that resulted in 2018 in 101% rise in Emiratis being in the private sector, which is huge. It's double, basically. And then this year alone, there's been 30,000 jobs up for grabs for Emiratis as well. So that's just completely in alignment with what the Hayes article is saying. There's a real push for the private sector to be more alluring for Emiratis. And as a result, there's, you know, they're making offers that are more alluring. And it's not an option. It's not something that private sectors can opt out of. It's something that is on the agenda of, it's part of the UAE vision, part of the 2021 vision, part of the 2031 vision. So completely seeing that myself, and it's all in alignment with the vision of the country.
It's one thing, though, to focus on it and to say, okay, you need to do it. What practically has changed, do you think, that's made the difference? What have companies been doing, or and recruitment companies and HR departments been doing, that has made a difference?
It does. I think it is at the attraction point, which is the salary and the allowances and things like that. I think those now those are being thought about. In the past, I think private sector had pay and benefit structures, and they would have had a social allowance or a national allowance, which wasn't really thought about. It would have just it was just tokenly put in there. And I think now a lot of them are reviewing their pay and benefit structures and actually reviewing the total cash that is given to UAE nationals and saying, actually, is that on par with what other UAE nationals are getting elsewhere in the market? There's a lot of competition now because there's a lot of pressure on private sector to hire UAE nationals. They need to now start analysing that stuff, which I don't think they did before. I think before it was, right, we need to give them, let's say, 20% more than everyone else. But I don't think that was done through pure analysis. Whereas now I think, you know, when I create pay and benefit structures for companies, that's my area of consulting, I will actually look at what UAE nationals get elsewhere within government, within other private sectors. You can actually get that kind of analysis if you pay for the data, and I will create a pay structure and ensure that they can get that they can get the same competitive rate in that company as they can elsewhere.
One stat you mentioned there, 30,000 private sector jobs available, say Hayes, for this year. How many Emiratis are looking for jobs?
Well, I think I'm not
sure.
Do we
know numbers?
I don't know numbers, I'm afraid. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't know numbers, but I think the fact that there's 30,000 jobs out there, what I would say is that
number... Well, that sounds more than the potential supply to me.
It does sound more than the supply, but what I would say that goes hand in hand with is there just seems to be so many expatriate job seekers in the market right now. So I feel that this year there's been more expatriate job seekers than I have experienced in my whole sort of 5 years being here. So that makes me think that that goes hand in hand with the fact that actually Emiratis are now more in demand than expatriates are, but I couldn't give you exact numbers.
Do you feel that in some ways that a glut of expatriates looking for work is because people have been made redundant, that we've gone through a wave of redundancies?
There's been a wave of redundancies. You know, quite a few of my friends have actually been made redundant as well. And I think a lot of jobs, such as support roles specifically, are being targeted at Emiratis, even in the private sector. So a lot of people that might have worked in HR, finance, IT, procurement, those sort of areas, and now customer services as well, and now being made redundant, and these roles are being replaced by Emiratis. So I think that's also one of the reasons why there's a huge increase in job seekers in the expatriate market. Yeah.
What effect is all of this having on wages?
On wages. So I think the expatriate wages have actually decreased slowly over the years. If I have a look at 5 years ago, the wage of an expatriate versus now, the UAE nationals, I think it's actually decreased as well. Now, when Hayes says that the salaries are levelling out, I would say that's primarily at directorship level, that there's about a 7% difference between what a Emirati earns and what an expatriate earns. And the reason being is not because companies are trying to level out the salary. That's not actually the objective. The reason being that directors are generally in low supply, and to attract them, you just have to pay them a lot of money, either from across the globe or from here. So I don't think it's ever a case of let's try and level out the salaries. Because if you look at some of the lower levels, so managerial levels, there's a 25% difference between what UAE nationals and expatriates pay. And if you look at customer service and support, there's 111% difference. So I don't think the salaries are levelling out, and it wouldn't be in line with the vision either, but the levelling out is more at director level.
I think I'm right in saying that there's still a target for banks to have 40% Emiratis. How many other quotas are there in other industries?
In a lot of government companies, it's as high as 70%. So when a lot of my clients are actually government, so when I create a pay and benefit structure, it's actually you have a separate Emirati pay and benefit structure. So you actually have two. So you have one for expatriates and one for Emiratis. That only happens in government. And the reason it happens is because of the really high quotas of 60%+. A lot of companies are being given incentives to hire Emiratis as well. So things like getting their labour reduction costs on labour permit cards, reduction costs on certain other, so there's a bank deposit, you know, they get exemptions from bank deposit requirements. So things like that. So there's some incentives that companies are given for hiring Emiratis as well. So
hiring's one thing, though. Talk to me about retention.
Retention. So I think attraction is all about salary. I think when someone's in the role, it's way more than that. So that's why, you know, if you look at certain programs like Tautine, which is one of the emeritization programs, and there's ENDB as well, they're emeritization programs that have come out, and they are looking at emeritization in a holistic way. So yes, they're looking at the attraction part, which is about salary and allowances, but they're also working with private sector about their training, their development, their promotion opportunities. So this is a big area as well that's being looked at. Another area that's being looked at is there's national funding for Emiratis that want to start their own businesses. So it's a holistic approach, the emiratization. It's not just let's attract them into the private sector. It's let's attract them into the private sector. Let's grow them. Let's develop them. Let's continue attracting them in the public sector. Let's encourage them to become entrepreneurs. So it's a holistic view to make them contributors of the society. And
which is an interesting point that you've made there. It's not just that it's the competition is between public sector and private sector, it's also between private sector and entrepreneurship, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think a lot of millennial Emiratis are actually now, I read that they're now less interested, and I'm seeing this as well, they're less interested in pay and benefits and actually now more interested in job content challenges and working somewhere quite cool, basically. So, you know, startups and things like that are very attractive for Emiratis now, the millennials. So I think that's a really positive step where we're seeing now UA nationals are, yes, they're interested in paying benefits, but actually they're also interested in content and challenge in the workplace as well.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thanj Kurganathan, the founder of Visible HR. Pleasure to have you back in the studio so soon.
Thank you for having me.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Evening, you're listening to The Business Breakfast, and I'm Malcolm Taylor. Solar power is gaining momentum in the Middle East, and it's an important theme, or has been an important theme, at this year's World Energy Congress, which was on last week. But a lack of financing remains a challenge for businesses to make the switch to solar. Not only that, but of course a lack of roof space as well. This is Jeremy Crane, the CEO of Yellow Door Energy. It's appropriate to have you in just after the World Energy Congress up in the capital, and the focus was on renewables in many ways. What did the Congress say about solar in particular?
Well, I think one of the most important things that was the discussion is how are we going to empower the transition to a low carbon world? We all know that natural gas, oil are here and they're going to be part of our mix for a long time, but we need to start making that transition.
Was there any sort of estimate? People were always estimating peak oil, when the decline of oil will start. Most people were saying sometime in the 2030s. But when do we think that renewables will be the majority of our energy consumed?
Look, I think it's really important to break it down into segments. If you're looking at what's powering cars, if you're looking at what's powering mobile infrastructure versus businesses, there's a big difference. What we are focused on is the business segment. How are businesses getting their energy? And we see that going more and more towards renewables, towards energy efficiency in the next 5 years, next 10 years.
I mean, one of the issues that jumps out at me is that the vast majority of businesses are in buildings with common roof space. And without the ability to control what happens on the roof or even demand roof space. So how do you do that if you're a company with the best will in the world, but you're in a 50-story building or a 20-story building or whatever, and you've got a limited roof space?
You know what? That's a really challenging question. In certain markets, they've managed it through wheeling. So for in Jordan, for instance, and it's coming up in Pakistan, Egypt, companies can buy power elsewhere out in the desert where land is cheap, where there's lots of space, and we'll develop projects out there, and then the transmission grid provides a balancing between what's generated out in a desert and what's consumed on the 21st floor.
But that's more of an offset program, isn't it, rather than a direct solar power?
Well, yeah, you're offsetting what's being generated by the conventional fuel with what you're generating off in the desert. And so you still need to pay for the grid infrastructure. There has to be a fee to manage that. But in our dense communities of Dubai, that's the only way that we're going to service the high rises.
And you help corporates with solar panels and installation financing. I mean, how do you assess the untapped demand here for solar amongst Dubai's companies?
You know what? It's in Dubai itself, it's quite we're seeing a huge transition. I think we've seen it 3-4 years ago when we were getting started, we were seeing the early adopters. Today, we're really in that main growth phase. We've just turned on Nestle a few days ago. We've got Carrefour under construction right now, Carrefour Jordan. So things are moving in the mainstream today, and we're optimistic that's going to be probably doubling every year for the next few years.
Mark's mentioned there that you provide finance. You do solar leases. How do they work?
Yeah, so the way a solar lease works is that you're contracting, just like you'd lease a car for a time period, 10, 15, 20 years, and you're committed to using the power from the solar system for that period of time. The value you pay on a monthly basis is based on the generation or the performance of the asset.
How does it compare? I mean, because what you're doing there basically is not shelling out for a capital investment, are you? Assuming that you had the roofs to put the solar powers on. How does the lease compare financially to that CapEx?
Well, that's going to vary a lot, right? If you're dealing with a company that's got a low cost of capital, they're probably going to, they would be able to get lower cost money than what we're providing. But for many businesses, it's less about the exact, that actual cost of money. It's around the whole turnkey system. If you're making milk and that's your core competency, why would you worry about your energy mix? We come in and offer you 30, 40% less than what's coming from the grid. It makes sense.
I mean, how ready is DEWA to accept surplus energy from companies in the Emirates?
Well, right now, DEWA is being very progressive in that. This is their program, and we're very supportive of what they've done to date. The primary logic for them to do this is that they want to reduce the peak demand midday. And by doing that, they can hopefully lower the CapEx they have in their plants.
So I've got a small building. I've got a couple of companies, a 2 or 3 story building. We've got plenty of roof space. We'll put solar panels up there. It feeds the building and does everything we need to do. And I can sell the surplus back to DEWA. How does that process work?
Well, first of all, it's important to know that you're not actually selling it. It's a netting. So if you generate more...
I won't get any money from it.
No. If you get any more at one point of the day, if you generate more than you're using, you get a credit. And then when you aren't generating, you can use up those credits. So it's a trade with DEWA.
Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about the move forward in solar. Jeremy Crane, CEO of Yellow Door Energy. Thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Evening, you're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. My name is Malcolm Taylor. Masdar identified very early on that investment into passenger vehicles, electric passenger vehicles, would play the biggest part in carbon reduction. Dr. Nicholas Matanis, the advisor to the CEO of Masdar, explains how they've made this a priority.
Let me first introduce Masdar, if I may. So we're part of the Mubadala Investment Company, which is a diversified Abu Dhabi sovereign wealth fund. And we at Masdar handle the sustainability sector. So essentially we invest in renewable energy on the power generation side, solar and wind mainly, as well as sustainable real estate here in Masdar City in Abu Dhabi. So as part of our investments in the sector, we identified early on that the electrification of mobility as a sector is a key driver for decarbonization and a key megatrend. And I say this because 15% of global carbon emissions come from the transport sector, 70% of that is the road sector itself. So at Masdar, we started investing in the sector early on with the establishment of the PRT. This is a semi-autonomous electric vehicle that was operational at Masdar City since 2010. We have recently extended our investments by introducing an autonomous electric vehicle by Navia, and you can see this in Masdar City if you visit us. And we also invested in manufacturing an electric bus that operates here in Abu Dhabi. So as part of this knowledge of the sector, we wanted to see how we take advantage of this opportunity. We looked at the value chain. We thought investing on the charging infrastructure itself is something that makes us comfortable. We are not in the business of manufacturing vehicles. We are not in the business of mining rare minerals. So investing in charging infrastructure is the play for us. And the reason why we did it now, and that's an important point, is because we're reaching a tipping point for the sector. It's the confluence of the economics, of the governmental policy and governmental support. Various schemes are being introduced, and also consumer awareness. So we believe that these three reasons make this investment timely.
Why invest in a UK infrastructure fund, though?
So when you look at where to invest globally, you have many opportunities. But when you try to identify the top five, UK does come up in the top five. It is a country with high consumer awareness of environmental issues. It has high disposable incomes, and the vehicles themselves remain fairly expensive. So you need a populace that has the ability to acquire the cars. And we believe that the UK government is committed to the electrification. Also, you have to look at every investment at the supply and demand. We believe that the market is very fragmented at the moment. It is, again, reaching the growth curve that makes it attractive. And we have a long-term thesis that appears to us very robust.
I'm looking at the UK market, Nicola. In the UK, there are 9,300 EV charging points, something like that. It's grown absolutely massively over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
But that compares to 8,400 or so petrol stations. But the petrol stations have each got sort of, you know, anything from sort of 8 to 20 pumps. So, you know, you're looking at many multiples of that 8,400. That was effective just last month. So there looks like there's a massive, massive demand if you're going to service all of the electric cars that are due to come online. How many are you looking to support or to build or to finance?
Well, it will depend on the type of charger that you actually install, because you have to understand not every charger is like every other charger. It depends on the power rating. It can cost you anywhere from £5,000 to install a charger to £200,000. It depends on the power rating. We are looking at specifically rapid public chargers. You have to understand that one major difference between owning an internal combustion engine vehicle versus owning an electric vehicle is the amount of time it takes to fuel your car or charge your car in the latter case. The battery needs to be charged in an amount of time that is convenient to you, the consumer. Otherwise, it just isn't practical for you. So that will determine the number of chargers. We expect that over the next couple of years, the number of rapid chargers in the UK will have to double. And that is as demand for electricity increases.
What are the rapid chargers doing the charging? About what, 10 minutes, something like that?
That will depend on the rating on the charger. If I take the average car battery that is 50 kilowatt hours of capacity and say that an average rapid charger is 100 kilowatts, then it takes about half an hour to charge your vehicle.
This may be a very simple question, but does every single car have the same plug? They've got the ability to take a charge from a 3-pin plug, from a rapid charger? It's not like VHS and Betamax. So there's only one plug, is there? Only one type of plug?
Well, unfortunately, manufacturers never really coordinate on these things.
Yeah.
But fortunately enough, there are adapters you can use. And as long as the network is not proprietary and is open to the public, then you should be able to use any kind of charger.
Nicholas Moutinus, the advisor to the Mazda CEO, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks for listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. We're back tomorrow, 6 a.m., with the Business Breakfast Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.